lost in the fog of a cosmic storm. Floating on whimsical wavelengths is the norm. Dancing through the stars, chasing spectrums of light. Riding the waves that are just out of sight.
Welcome back to Whimsical Wavelengths. Today we step back in the Wayback Machine. No, not to Retro Thursdays, but almost. It's hard for me to think of 1993 as retro, but yes, that's where we're going to start. Jurassic Park, the movie. Iconic phrases from that movie in 1993. Your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think they should. And life finds a way. In retrospect, a very dystopian way of looking at science. It seems it is an underlying theme of fears with respect to technology. We are always just one discovery away from inventing our own downfall. Well, I'm not saying we couldn't. Perhaps I should find someone to explore that topic in more detail. However, that is not what we're talking about today. We're talking about dinosaurs, and they never had that issue. Because they couldn't invent new technologies, and, well, their demise came from space. On that note, what's a dinosaur's least favorite reindeer? It's Comet. So, Jurassic Park. Honestly, what a movie. It was how you say dynamite. Dinosaurs brought to life on the big screen in ways that had not been done previously. Not only was the movie good, the book too, by the way, I think it was pretty accurate to what we understood at the time. We'll find out in a moment, but I suspect it was like Dante's Peak, which definitely had some problems, but was the most accurate volcano disaster movie made by Hollywood. And yeah, we covered that in episode 3. Here, in Jurassic Park, the paleontologist John Jack R. Horner was the expert they brought in as an advisor and was also the inspiration for the main character in the books. Bringing him on to advise in the filming definitely made a difference. The best example of bringing science into Jurassic Park definitely has to be the dinosaurs are not cold-blooded. This scientific change or reclassification began in the late 1960s. However, by then dinosaurs in the popular conscience was large, lumbering, cold-blooded lizards. Jurassic Park is what changed that perception for the general public. In one scene, a velociraptor was about to enter the kitchen and looked through a window, snorted, and fogged it up. Only a warm-blooded animal can do that. The original scene actually suggested a tongue like a snake to be visible in the window. The fogging up of the glass was so much better and scarier. So today we're going to explore what we knew when Jurassic Park was created and how it was changed since. And we'll also talk a lot more about the evolutionary cousins to the famed T-Rex. And again, I brought in a guest to get it done. Someone who is much better at pronouncing all of these names that make me nervous just thinking about how to spell them. Just like, what do you call a nervous dinosaur? A nervous Rex. Also, I've decided to split this interview into two. Otherwise, this episode would have been way too long. So, this is part one, and in part two, we get into much more detail of his research. And unfortunately, this is going to end a bit like a cliffhanger, because I had no idea that this was going to be a two-parter before I started. Sit back and enjoy. So, Dr. Francois Terrin, the curator of dinosaur paleoecology at the Royal Tyrrell Museum located in Drumheller, Alberta, obtained his PhD from Johns Hopkins University in 2004. And reading just from the professional highlights located on his work webpage, he discovered the first feathered dinosaurs of North America, researched Cryodrachon boris, a new species of petrosaur, published on a theropod site from Mongolia that reveals the colonial nesting behavior first evolved in dinosaur ancestors of birds, and researched Thanatotheretus degrudorum.
That one's a mouthful.
So welcome, Dr. Francois Terrin, to Whimsical Wavelengths.
Well, thanks for having me. So I'm happy to be here.
And I'm excited. Listeners will hopefully remember, because it was only two episodes ago, where I described my first scientific love, which was dinosaurs. And just for Dr. Francois here, yeah, it was completely derailed because of what I've learned at the very place that you work and reside at, which is the Royal Tyrrell Museum. which the museum is awesome, and we'll circle back there closer to the end, I promise. I was thinking we'd start with Jurassic Park, the iconic 90s movie, and then dive into your research, provide some context of some of the avenues we're currently to learn about the past and dinosaurs, and then come to look at the present and future. And of course, feel free to derail the conversation, take it anywhere. So, the original movie, did it have any effect on you and the science you decided to pursue?
I was already too old. I was already starting my undergrad studies at the university at the time the movie came out in 93. So I became fascinated with dinosaurs. It was truly a passion at the age of four when I received my first dinosaur book. And at that time, I knew I was going to become a paleontologist studying dinosaurs. And I was just either too stubborn or too stupid to change my mind. And then I went on to go to undergrads. And so, yeah, so Dinosaur Park basically did not influence my decision because it had already been made for a long time. But I know that now lots of the students and even the recent graduates, the recent PhD graduates, they're part of what we call the Jurassic Park generation, where Jurassic Park was a big influence in their decision to pursue paleontology.
So you didn't even have a different avenue of attack with your own research because of the movies? It was completely just separate?
Yeah. I was already set. I knew I was going to study dinosaurs. I did not have a plan B, and I was... In hindsight, it was probably stupid not to have a plan B. But nowadays, yeah, you definitely need a plan B because there's so many people that the students that have seen Dinosaur Park, six Jurassic Park movies now. And
I swear they get worse too after.
Yeah. The first one was definitely good. Second one was okay. After that, it started going downhill. But now, there's so many students who want to become paleontologists that you definitely need a plan B because just like volcanologists, it's not a very common position that you can land at a university or a research institute. So you definitely need a plan B in case that you don't end up in academia or somewhere else. So in my days already it was tight, but today it's definitely a must.
Yeah, it's somewhat much harder.
Yeah,
my plan B was working in mineral industry, and that's what I'm doing now. So
awesome. So it worked out great.
It worked out okay. I'd still rather be poking lava with a stick.
Wouldn't we all? Sounds like fun.
It's hot. But perhaps, jumping back in, my favorite scene in the first Jurassic Park, the best out of all of the movies, was when the Tyrannosaurus was chasing the Jeep. And I just remember the mirror, and you could just... Maybe you couldn't make out the words specifically, but you knew what they said. And it was like, objects may appear close or maybe closer than they appear. Yes. So to understand some of your research, I thought it'd be good to start with the dinosaur everyone seems to know about, even when they know nothing about dinosaurs, and then try jumping into the deep end. So how did the Jurassic Park do with depicting the T-Rex?
Well, from a physical appearance, it was really, really good. Well, at least based on the knowledge we had in 1993, basically a T-Rex was really lifelike, was held horizontally, walking horizontal and not upright. So in terms of physical appearance, I think they did a great job for T-Rex. It just when it came into its lifestyle, its behavior, that's when there was a little bit more of imagination rather than hard science involved in reconstructing it. So as you said, gave the example of T-Rex chasing the Jeep at like 50, or did it go up even to 80 miles an hour? I can't remember. First of all, a Jeep driving through the jungle at 80 miles an hour is science fiction, but basically having a T-Rex chase you at that speed. At the time, we did not really know how fast T-Rex could walk or run. So I guess it was kind of for the suspense of the movie, they made it chase it. But now, yeah, we know there's been lots of studies being published on the walking speed or the potential running speed of T-Rex. And now we know that, at It's got the normal pace when a T-Rex would just have been walking around. We're looking at about 4.6 kilometers an hour. So in miles, that would be maybe something like 2.8 miles an hour. And then the maximum speed. The issue is T-Rex is so big that to accelerate an animal that big to 50 or 80 miles an hour, you need so much muscle mass in the legs that basically all the mass of the animal would be in the legs. There would be no room for muscles anywhere else. It would become so heavy, all bulked up in the legs and skinny everywhere else, that it's actually physically impossible. So the fastest, it's not even running, it's actually walking speed. Running is defined as when both of your legs are off the ground. And T-Rex, it was just too big to attain true running. It could walk fast, but it couldn't run. But even its fastest running speed is about 28 kilometers an hour, which is about 18 miles an hour. So it's a far cry from the 50 to 80 miles an hour depicted in the Jurassic Park. So they got that one wrong. But the worst to me is probably the line that most people remember is when the little girl and the little boy are facing the T-Rex after he tore apart the Jeep. And then the paleontologist tells him, be quiet and don't move. T-Rex can't see you if you don't move. Well, that's the worst piece of advice a paleontologist has ever given. He's responsible for the death of those two kids because T-Rex has excellent stereoscopic vision, meaning that its eyes are facing forward and it has great depth perception. So lots of other theropods have eyes that are positioned farther to the side. So for them, depth perception would not have been good. But for T-Rex, it would have been excellent. And you did not need to move to be seen. It would definitely have been able to still see those little kids there and probably even smell their fear and would just have eaten them right there.
Yeah, maybe to put a finer point on it, I guess even if the eyes were further apart, wouldn't really matter because he'd just turn his head, wouldn't he?
Well, that's the thing. When your eyes are farther apart, you have it would see you, but you don't have good depth.
Sure, but you would still know you're there. Like it wouldn't be like you'd there, be invisible.
But you may be lucky enough to blend with the background because animals with the eyes farther to the side, they notice you if you move relative to your background. Then it sees that, okay, it's there, it's close, it's moving. But if you stand still, you kind of blend. It can't tell if you're at the same distance from its from that animal as a tree behind or something even farther away. If you stand still, you all blend together. So it would see you, but it wouldn't know that you're right in front of it, for example.
Okay. Well, to be fair to the book, because the book was arguably better than the movie, which is hard to say, hard to imagine when the movie was so good. I think they gave the magic wand. It was the DNA we put in via the frog.
The book, but it's been so long ago, I don't remember what they came up with for that.
But either way, for sure. Now, to take the listener onto some more technical things, let's start with the T-Rex family, or Tyrannosaurids, or Tyrannosauridae, mm-hmm. and the clade, Coelurosaurian.
Sidurosauria?
Tongue twisters, which includes the T-Rex, basically clade, family, and naming conventions, because quite honestly, if you were uninitiated, you've never seen one of these before, it would look like a conspiracy theorist web connecting all kinds of different animals and species. So what are they and what's the differences?
Yeah. Well, in the old days, we go back to, probably 19th century or... Yes, I guess probably 19th century, when Linnaeus came up with a classification system for all living organism, wanted to place.
And Linnaeus was a professor, or
yeah, he was a biologist or a systematist in, I can't remember which country, from a European country, I can't remember which one. I think was it maybe even the Netherlands? I can't remember. Anyway, he came up with a classification scheme where every living organism clearly within groups. So that's why he came up with basically a kingdom, phyla, families, genus, and species. So every animal could be classified really clearly. But the issue now is that Linnaeus at the time did not believe in evolution. He was a really religious man, and he thought that the world had been created the way we see it today. But now with the understanding of evolution, we see that things are way more gradual. Nothing in the world clearly fit in the bins that he had created. So now we need to create other groups, other names to encompass a bigger group of animals. So Tyrannosaurus Day used to be what we call a family. It includes all the animals that are really closely related to T-Rex. So T-Rex is just one example of a big bipedal dinosaur with a big head and big massive teeth. But there's other species that are very similar. For example, Albertosaurus is one, Gorgosaurus, Thanatotheristes, the one you tried to pronounce earlier during the introduction. So those animals all look like T-Rex, but basically they have slight differences, but they're all generally similar, so we put them in the same family, Tyrannosauridae. The group Coelurosauria is actually a clade that encompasses meat-eating dinosaurs that we call theropods that include the group of T-Rex, but also a whole bunch of other dinosaurs, like we can include the ostrich mimic dinosaurs,
Velociraptors,
Velociraptor, the dromaeosaurs, troodontids, birds. Those are all called coelurosaurs because they had hollow pockets in some of their bones. More primitive theropods like Allosaurus, that's a famous one, Ceratosaurus, Coelophysis, those lack some of the characteristics. So those are outside of that group that we'd call Coelurosauria. They would be Titanurans or Neotheropods and different groups. So they receive different names based on where they fit in the evolutionary tree of meat-eating dinosaurs or theropods.
Okay, so the taxonomics, so that's like the family, and all of a sudden my name drew a blank about the phylum and the other names associated with that. And then the clade is just a group. A clade
is something that's not within the strict categories of Linnaeus. Linnaeus had class, order, family, subfamily, genus, species. A clade is something with the advent of a method called cladistics that groups animals or living organisms based on shared similarities. Basically, then, sometimes the old classification of Linnaeus falls apart there because there are so many intermediates that basically we don't have, there's not enough categories using the Linnaean system to give them names to those branches on an evolutionary tree. So that's why now we use the term a clade that comes from a cladistic analysis for some of those groups because they don't fit within the scheme of Linnaeus.
Okay, so they generally are much more broad.
Yes.
Okay. Splitters versus lumpers.
Yes. Although, even to make things more complicated, a family is also a clade. A clade doesn't have a level. It can be anything. Clade can be a group of species together. It can be a family. It could be a class. It just represents, if you look at the evolutionary tree, the node between two branches and all the subsequent branches. So it's a more general term that doesn't have to fit within the Linnaean systematics, the Linnaean classification, but that can be at any level. Can be species, can be family, can be order, can be even higher, or can fall in between. So that's basically a name we give for a group without specifying where it should fit within the Linnaean classification.
So it doesn't have any strong rules associated with it.
Exactly. It just means that basically a clade is a group of dinosaurs that basically have a common ancestor and all of the descendants of that common ancestor. When you look at the evolutionary tree, it's basically all the animals from that split between the node between the two branches and all the branches above that node. That's what would form a clade. And usually, sometimes, not always, we give names to those nodes between branches for ease of communication, basically.
Okay. Well, hopefully that clears up for anyone who
probably not without seeing a diagram.
It's still gonna look like a conspiracy. All the data's connected with little red lines all over the place.
Yeah.
But just as I mentioned off the top, your research is so much wider than just say theropods or Tyrannosauridae, because it's only one episode that I have you here for, at least for now. Who are the tyrannosaurs that you study, and how do they compare to the quote unquote king, the T-Rex?
I study mostly tyrannosaurs. Tyrannosaurus is another way. It includes all the animals that are on the lineage leading to T-Rex, but not necessarily Tyrannosauridae, because there's lots of ancestors to those animals that don't look like T-Rex. In fact, very primitive tyrannosaurs were very small animals that were feathered. They had long arms. They had many fingers, not only two. They had smaller heads. So those, they're all on the lineage, lead on the branch, if you want, leading to T-Rex, but they don't look like T-Rex. So those we usually call tyrannosaurs in general. So I study a different group, different species of tyrannosaur. The most common ones are those we find here in Alberta, because Alberta is one of the top five places in the world where you find an extremely high number of dinosaur skeletons. So I study the most common ones we have here are Tyrannosaurids, so part of the closed group of animals that look like T-Rex. That includes Gorgosaurus and Albertosaurus. So those are distant cousins to T-Rex, but they still look fairly similar to T-Rex. They're just more lightly built, and they tend to have a slightly longer leg. So they were probably more active, more athletic, ran a little bit faster. But overall, they looked like a T-Rex. So I'm mainly interested in learning about their biology or their ecology, what they were doing when they were alive, and what they were eating. So that's what I'm mainly interested in.
Awesome. And I'm going to try to say those exact same Tyrannosaur names in just a second, because as I was getting ready for this episode, I found something both surprising and yet obvious. The Albertosaurines, i.e. the Albertosaurus, which you just mentioned, and the Gorgosaurus, I also have names after the first one, like Libratus. I guess there's multiple.
Again, it comes from the Linnean classification. Every animal is given two names, a genus name and a species name. So usually we shorten it by just saying Albertosaurus or Gorgosaurus, but in reality, we should say the full two words, which would be Albertosaurus sarcophagus, just like T-Rex. It's Tyrannosaurus rex. So Tyrannosaurus is a genus name. Rex is a species name. So the same would go for Albertosaurus and Gorgosaurus. It should be Albertosaurus sarcophagus and Gorgosaurus libratus. But to simplify things, we just use the genus names. We'll say Albertosaurus and Gorgosaurus.
Sure. So those are there's only one species associated with Albertosaurus.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. So besides the fact that this is an episode of Tongue Twisters, both of these are fairly well represented in the fossil record. Some of the others from the same age and different places, not so much. So to start, why are these two species so representative in our fossil record in comparison to others?
Yeah. Well, Gorgosaurus comes from a place in Alberta called Dinosaur Provincial Park. It's a small pocket of badlands in southern Alberta. It's only about 80 square kilometers, so it's not very big, but it is easily in the top five best. This is the best place in Canada where you find dinosaurs. When I say that Alberta ranks in the top five best places in the world to find dinosaurs, it's in large part because of Dinosaur Provincial Park. Since the beginning of the 20th century, expeditions from various museums around the world have just gone directly for that pocket of badlands and pulled out hundreds. We're talking about 300 to 400 significant skeletons of dinosaurs that have been pulled out of the ground and sent to museum all over North America, and sometimes even elsewhere in the world. Such that if you go to a museum in North America and you see a beautiful skeleton of a horned dinosaur or a duck-billed dinosaur, nine times out of 10, it will be coming from Dinosaur Provincial Park. So the reason why we know Gorgosaurus so well is because it's mainly preserved in Dinosaur Provincial Park. So we have lots of skeletons for that species of different growth stages, from very small individuals all the way to fully grown adults. So that's why, yeah, this is probably the best known Tyrannosaur after T-Rex. And then Albertosaurus is a little bit more poorly known. It's definitely not as well known as Gorgosaurus, but we still have several specimens for it. And again, it's because it's from Alberta, and we have an excellent fossil record here in the province.
Okay, but I guess more to the question is, like, fossils are rare. So what?
Except in Alberta.
Well, but why is that? Like, what allowed them to be preserved here and not other places?
Yeah, it's because Alberta has the perfect combination of two factors. First, it has the perfect geologic record. So we have most of the bedrock here in the province consists of rocks that were deposited by rivers and lakes back during the age of the dinosaurs, specifically during the Cretaceous. So this means that, yeah, we have lots of rivers and lakes that flowed, and then once in a while they would flood, spill over their banks, and then bury whatever animals or carcasses were lying around. So you'd have animals that were already dead, or animals that died during the flood that got buried and then got fossilized. And then the second factor that's also really important is that we have an arid climate here in Alberta. We don't have vast forests covering the landscape. Instead, we have mostly grasslands, at least in the southern part of the province. So that's why, yeah, with grasses, there's not that strong network of roots to stabilize the ground. So erosion takes place, especially along rivers. And there, with the combination of aridity, so this means there's not much rainfall, so not much vegetation, erosion takes place and carves what we call badlands, a landscape of canyons and rounded hills with almost no vegetation, where the bedrock is exposed. And because the bedrock consists of sedimentary rocks that formed during the age of the dinosaurs, thanks to erosion, that's why we find so many dinosaur bones here in the province.
So we've gone over kind of like why these two are so well known in comparison to some of the others. We've mentioned that fossils are rare. It just happened to be the environment that Albertosaurus and Gorgosaurus lived and now are able to be found because of the arid environment of. So first you get buried, and then we can only find them because of the erosion and the fact that we have access to the ground instead of a forest.
Yes.
So that isn't the case everywhere. So I assume that's part of the reason why many specimens are, you find only little bits of, and you don't find many of them to be able to classify them. So based on that, it seems like it perhaps maybe shouldn't be as surprising, but the number of times that I've seen specimens reclassified from their own species, like brand new species, here's a paper, to actually this is an adolescence of this other species. That seems to happen so often in your line of work.
Yes, it's because we don't have modern analogs or similar animals alive today. So that's why, especially in the early days of paleontology, like at the end of the 19th century, most of the time, finding a complete skeleton of a dinosaur, it's really rare. It's the exception rather than the rule. Most of the times, you'll just find some bones scattered around, like part of a leg, a few bones of the skeleton, but basically you don't find a whole animal. So yeah, with such a limited skeletal evidence, such limited fossil material, oftentimes you make mistake that basically you discover something, you think it's something else, and then a new specimen is discovered that's more complete, and then you realize actually, yeah, those bones you had found belong to that other species instead of what you had initially thought. So that's part of the reason why things are changing often. Identity basically is because we have such limited material, we think it's one thing, but then a better new specimen is discovered that's more complete, and then we realize that our initial specimen was something else. The other thing also is that dinosaurs change dramatically during their growth. I mean, everybody thinks that dinosaurs are those big animals, but those big animals had to come out of an egg. So this means they're you're talking with an animal of the animals that at birth, they're somewhere between 60 centimeters long to a meter, and then they have to reach basically 10, 13 meters in length, and some like the sauropods, the long-necked dinosaurs, those could reach 35 to 40 meters. So there's a huge amount of growth that takes place. And these animals, over the course of their growth, changed in appearance. Basically, when you're a small animal, you can't do, like when you're a baby T-Rex, you can't feed the same way as mama T-Rex is, who can tackle big triceratops or big hadrosaurs. When you're a tiny little baby, you have to go after smaller prey. So you're not going to be built exactly the same way as your mama. So this means that species changed appearance during their growth. And that's something that we start realizing, although now it sounds totally logical, but we didn't really realize that until I'd say the past 15 to 20 years, that actually lots of species that had been described before were actually just juvenile or young forms, young individuals of an adult species. And that was discovered with the what we call histology. If you cut through a limb bone, you can see growth rings, just like a tree that basically shows the animal is getting bigger and bigger through life. And when it reaches adulthood, there's a clear mark in the outside of the bone. You can see lots of growth lines that are closely spaced together, meaning the animal has essentially stopped growing. It's just growing a tiny little bit every year. So now we realize that some of those small species we had before, when we cut their bones, we see that they're still young. They're not adults. So they're just, we initially had called them a different species, but now we realize that they're just juvenile forms, that they belong to an older species, and their appearance is just changing through life. So that's what's also responsible for so much shuffling around in paleontology, is now we realize that some of the species we had previously erected or created turned out to be just a juvenile form from a previously known species that had been named based on an adult specimen.
Yeah, so just to be completely crass here, the only way to fix science is with more science.
Totally, yeah, and you need more discoveries. That's why, yeah, oftentimes we go in the field and people say, well, don't you have enough fossils already? Your museum is full, why don't you stop? Well, the thing is, we always need to
wait. People have actually said that to you?
Oh yeah.
Really?
Oh yeah. They say, yeah, you have enough in your museum. Why do you keep going out? Shouldn't you spend money doing something else? I was like, no, we need to collect more, because the specimens we have, they represent one individual. And if you want to know more about the species, you need to have a lot more specimens. And every new specimen has chances of preserving something previously unknown. For example, you mentioned earlier the discovery of the first feathered ornithomimid, first ostrich mimic dinosaurs in North America that I was part of. We have lots of skeletons of these animals, and the one that we discovered was actually really badly eroded, really badly preserved. But we said, hey, it's a meat-eating dinosaur. Those are not very common, so we'll collect it anyway. And it's as we were digging and I was chipping away at rocks that basically I lifted a piece and it preserved lots of feather impressions on it. And feathered dinosaurs had never been discovered in North America. So I joked around, if we were in China, we'd call those feathers. And as I kept chipping, more chips came out with feather impressions. So then we realized, okay, we're dealing with something that we've never seen before. And then, yeah, and that specimen looked like really a crappy specimen, but we had something that had never been discovered before associated with that specimen. So it's proof that you always need to search for more data, more specimens, because you never know, the next discovery could reveal something that was previously unknown.
Absolutely. Little bit off track, but that is what we like here. Getting back to how these dinosaurs changed, specifically the ones that you study, when we start talking about these large theropods, they must go through some really significant changes. I know some of it because I got ready for this interview, but some of it I don't quite understand. So to go from a small little dinosaur that eats bugs to a giant dinosaur that's going to take on us triceratops, like what, how, it's more than just losing your baby teeth.
Yes. First off, yeah, dinosaurs don't have baby teeth. They replace their teeth throughout their lives. Mammals, we're the
freaks
of nature. Yeah, just like a shark. Mammals like us, we're the freaks of nature where we only have two sets of teeth, baby teeth and adult teeth. But all other animals, well, except birds that don't have teeth or no longer have teeth because their ancestors did. But yeah, they replace their teeth throughout their lives, just like sharks. But what we see is, yeah, when we look at, I looked specifically at Gorgosaurus and Arborosaurus. I looked at their jaws and their teeth, and I saw that when they're really young, they had very weak bites, similar to typical for a theropod of their own size, and their teeth were very blade-like, just like steak knives, very designed for slicing through flesh. But then as they start growing, when they reach around the age of 11, that's when we see changes. Their bite force, their jaws, and their skulls start becoming way more robust, solidly built, and their bite force starts increasing exponentially. And then it's at that stage also where we see their teeth are changing. They go from very blade-like to more rotund, a little bit fatter. And that's for being able to seize and hold onto prey and also crush through bones. And we see that transition happening around the age of 11. And then it just keeps on going all the way to adulthood. So that tells us that these dinosaurs underwent a change in diet during their lifespan, over the course of their lives. When they're very young, they probably just delivered little slashing bites similar to a Komodo dragons, did not hold on to their prey, and then they just dismembered small species of dinosaurs and baby dinosaurs. And then it's starting at the age of 11, that's when their skulls and their jaws start becoming more solidly built, their bite force start increasing exponentially, and their teeth became more rotund. And that's probably when they started gradually transitioning to a new diet, mainly feeding on larger herbivores like duck-billed dinosaurs and horned dinosaurs. So we see that, yeah, during the over the course of a tyrannosaur's life, they're dramatically changing, and they're occupying different ecological niches. When they're young, they're small to medium-sized predators. And when they grow to large size, then they become the apex predators or the top predators of their ecosystem.
Okay, so kilogram for kilogram or pound for pound, which dino had the strongest bite? Do we know? And I assume there must be a contest out there. Who takes home the gold?
Yeah, well, definitely based on my study, lots of scientists have estimated the bite force of T-Rex, and by far it's the most powerful bite measured. But using their methods, you can only do one specimen at a time, so it's not very good if you want to compare among others. And I can't remember, it's something astronomical in terms of pounds per square inches. The bite force of T-Rex numbers are like in the thousands or tens of thousands of pounds per square inches. It's something crazy. But if you compare with other theropods, like there's other meat-eating dinosaurs that are just as big as T-Rex, but we don't know their bite force. So thanks to my method, I was able to compare. I can't give you a number in pounds per square inches, but I can just do a comparative bite force. Say, okay, this one had a bite force that many times more powerful than this other animal. And that's where we see that, yeah, young tyrannosaurs had a bite force that was typical of any other theropod of their body size. It's when you get to 11, starts increasing exponentially. And when they get to fully grown animals, like a Suda T-Rex that's in at the Field Museum in Chicago, or even the big specimens we see at the American Museum of Natural History. When you see a big mount of T-Rex, it's usually the American Museum of Natural History specimen. Those animals had bite force that was five times stronger than the largest theropods known. So basically animals like Gigantosaurus. So T-Rex is true, and tyrannosaurs in general are truly in a league of their own. They're totally unlike any other theropods, and that's because they shrunk their arms so they can no longer use their hands to grasp prey. They have to do all their killings with their bites. So they basically kill their prey, bite hard, and crush through bones. Whereas other theropods can still use their hands to do that. And just for comparison, yeah, saying that, okay, T-Rex, the bite force of T-Rex is 5 times bigger than that of the largest theropod known. That doesn't say much. Let's compare it to an alligator, a modern alligator. Well, T-Rex, the largest T-Rex, has a bite force 15 times that of a modern alligator. So it truly shows that, yeah, T-Rex is definitely, yeah, in a league of its own. There's no other animal that had a bite that powerful.
Okay, so T-Rex comes by its infamy or famous nature. It's not just make-believe, it's real.
Oh, no. Yeah, every studies that focus on T-Rex or Tyrannosaurids, the group of T-Rex and its relative, all show that these animals are truly unique, that they're doing something quite unlike any other theropod or meat-eating dinosaurs done before. And they're truly, can see the kings of dinosaurs, because they were the top predators in their ecosystems. And then, there was nothing else that could compete with them.
Okay, that brings this part of the interview to a close. Sorry to leave you a bit on a cliffhanger there, but that's okay. You're going to so enjoy part two. Remember, this podcast is going to keep working as long as you guys keep listening. And the more you interact with me, the better this podcast is going to be. So please do so. You can catch me on all the social media. I'm not on X. I've spent a lot more of my time on Blue Sky, but I'm definitely on Facebook and Instagram as well. So drop me a line. Email in the show notes. Remember, hit subscribe. Tell a friend. And if you can, and you're able to, join the Patreon, where you can also have access to a Discord server to be able to contact me directly and we can chat. Until next time on Whimsical Wavelengths.
Lost in the fog of a cosmic storm, floating on whimsical wavelengths is the norm. Dancing through the stars, chasing spectrums of light, riding the waves that are just out of sight. In a world so chaotic that misbehaves, melodies that echo show us six always. Colors intertwine, painting the sky. We're lost in the rhythm as the universe flies by. Oh, we're tuned in, feeling the beat of the unknown. Can you hear it? It's echoing through your bones. And this melody